fans, we've heard a lot about Oz.
We sure have, and we're getting ready to take a look, I think, baby.
Once upon a time in a land far away, there lived a wizard, but not the Wizard of Oz. His name was the Great Wizard, and he ruled the Kingdom of Oz.
This guy, Oz, is huge.
Brother, this just knocked my socks right off right here. I ain't never seen nothing like that. This guy here looks to be, I would say, 7 foot tall.
At least seven feet tall.
And I'm going to tell you what, this is an awesome, awesome, awesome display. World Championship Wrestling is bringing it to you, baby. We're taking a look at Oz.
I'd unravel every riddle for any individual in trouble or in pain.
With the thoughts you'd be thinking, you could be another Lincoln if you only had a brain.
Oh, I will tell you why.
Welcome, everybody, to Review Away. And I am waiting. And joining me is not John Pollock. It is...
Woo! Straight out of rehab.
I thought you were gonna say Dusty Rhodes. I thought you were gonna do Dusty Rhodes impression for us.
Oh, that's right. We gotta talk about Super Brawl.
Dan the Mouth Lavransky, thank you for joining us on this show. Is this the first time we've done a review together?
You know what? It is. It is.
Yeah,
it is.
I thought so.
Yeah.
Jay was like telling us, trying to tell me that we did one before.
Just you and I?
Yeah. I don't seem to recall.
I don't remember if we did. I don't remember it either.
We could be mistaken. We do a lot of these. But thank you for joining us.
No problem. No problem, Way. This particular show will be a lot of fun because I was there in person. So I can tell you some stories and give you some insight.
All the way back in 1991?
Yeah.
Your memory is that good?
That's not bad. It's not bad. I know, despite my habits and things that I enjoy. My memory's not too bad.
Yeah. Before we move on to the review... You mentioned that you were a little late, which was fine because I was actually later than you to even start this review. But you said you were a little late because you went to stop by at Rotate This.
I have to. It's on a direct line to the Fight Network.
Rotate
right?
This is a pretty popular independent
record store.
Store here in Toronto. What were some things that you were looking at or picked up?
Right at the moment they've got a huge section of stuff that's on clearance. They've put a bunch of stuff in that's been sitting around forever and doesn't sell. And I really like old 40s and 50s R&B. And I really think a lot of the audience for that music is starting to die off. So they have a huge section in there where they had all this great old R&B records for cheap. So I got a Louis Jordan.
How great that audience is dying off.
Well, I know, but that's what the guy in the store said. He said that's the reason that he's marked some of that stuff down. Because the people that are interested in that kind of music are mostly much older. And they don't seem to be – the records aren't selling, right? Uh-huh. So it was great for me. I got some Little Richard. Louis Jordan, what was the other one I got? A Christmas record of all old R&B guys like James Brown and that doing Christmas tunes. And I also got the Flamin' Groovies because I'm going to see the Flamin' Groovies. They're playing here in Toronto in about 3 weeks.
With the exception of James Brown, all things I've never heard of, which is usually the case when I'm talking music with Mouth. But for those of you who don't know, Mouth and I, we chat music a lot, actually.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, I could say the same thing, Way. You're always telling me about different guys that I don't know about because a lot of times with newer stuff, I just don't see what's going on. I mean, I'm buying records of guys from the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
I don't always know what's going on. And a lot of times you'll be filling me in on the latest thing, what's going on.
Do you still have, I know you moved recently out of, your the place that you lived in for a long time into a larger place, so I'd assume you took your whole collection.
I did, but I have a garage sale once a year that helps clean out all the records, and I just take because I hit Goodwills constantly and stuff like that, and I just take everything that I didn't like from the year, and then I'll go through my big collection too and see if there's anything I'm really not that interested in anymore, because I used to have a lot of records that were just because I was doing the radio show on CIUT, and you don't really listen to them.
Campus station here.
Yeah, yeah, you don't really listen to them on your own, so I filter stuff like that out, and I have a sale once a year, and I actually do pretty good. I made $500 this year.
Really?
Yeah.
Or do you ever regret selling something?
Oh, yes. You know what way? Foolishly, when CDs first came in, I got rid of a lot of my records and traded stuff in so I could get CDs, and I do. I totally regret. In fact, I've actually bought a couple things I used to have.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, like what? What did you sell?
I had a couple Frank Zappa ones I regretted selling. What else did I get? John Entwistle's first solo album, The Bass Player with The Who. Very great record. Just a few. There was a few of them, you know.
I find it amazing that we chatted a little about this last time we spoke, but I find it amazing that, you know, despite seeing stores like HMV continue to close down and Blockbusters and whatnot, there are independent record stores selling vinyl exclusively that are opening up in this city.
Yeah, it's actually really good now, Way, if you think about it, because you have Rotate This, you have Sonic Boom, you have She Said Boom. Even Sunrise, which is a chain, the one that said Dundas and Young, has a huge used section upstairs.
Even like an HMV is starting to sell a lot more vinyl these days.
Yep. If you go into Rotate This, I think there's like one rack of CDs. And, like, that's it. And I think they're going to phase that out. Like, I think they're going to become just complete vinyl.
Well, it's very much like, I mean, I seem to have kind of developed a lot of thoughts about all this just through my interest in comic books, which you're also a fan of. But, I mean, comics, I think, for the most part, have been able to stay away from, like, the digital, piracy fad, I suppose. That's really crippled the music industry and movies.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you have to hold a comic book. Digital is cool, but like, there's nothing like holding a piece of art. And vinyl is very much that same thing.
Absolutely.
It's hardware. You can't really just download.
No, you're absolutely right, Way. I think, it depends what people like. I mean, some younger people, they just want the music and that's it. They don't care. But me, I've always been the type of guy I want to know about the bands I listen to. I'm interested by the personalities. I'm intrigued by the situations. And I think because also I grew up in the complete vinyl age too, so obviously I'm partial to that. But I love the big artwork. I love records, the gatefold records. Like, I just bought the Sadie's new record. I just love the fact it opens up. It's got cool picture, cool artwork. Mm-hmm. I agree. It's like a more complete piece of art. And I think for that reason, vinyl is always going to be collectible, whereas CDs, for the most part, are just falling by the wayside.
Yeah. Do you think that someday people will look with that much reverence at WCW Turner Home Classic video cassettes?
You know what? They might. Yeah. I mean, no, you don't think so?
I don't think so.
Okay. All right.
That's VHS. But this show, WCW Super Bowl, was released on VHS.
Yep.
In condensed version.
Yeah, they took out about 5 matches, I think, off
the
VHS.
A lot of gems were taken off.
You know what? A lot of fun stuff is missing on the VHS.
Yeah. Luckily, thank you to YouTube and to Daily Motion.
Yep.
We were able to watch every
It was all
match.
There. I found everything. Yep.
All 12 matches on this card. So those of you who did watch it or didn't even watch it, you'll get a full rundown from us. Let's get into the show. It's Super Brawl 1.
I just wanted to give you a little bit of background for this, because this was a really big thing for me, because by 1991, I was really getting tired of the WWF. WrestleMania 7 had just been a few months before, one of the worst WrestleManias of all time, Sergeant Slaughter versus Hulk Hogan on top with that stupid Iraqi angle. Hated it, and the popularity was really starting to fall down. I remember I had to go to one of the diviest bars in Toronto to watch WrestleMania 7. I thought I was going to get stabbed or wounded or a bottle thrown at me. It was incredible. Insane crowd in this total raunchy bar. And so it was really at a real low now. I was tired of it. WCW was on very minutely up here at the time. CFTO used to show it like midnights on Saturday nights, I think it was. And even then, they didn't show it every week. They often got preempted. But what I saw there, I just loved so much more. I thought the wrestling was way better. The personalities were more interesting. The grudges seemed more realistic. I just felt it seemed more realistic to me, although there are things on this pay-per-view that were not realistic at all.
Yeah.
But I just felt felt it was a more of a convincing product. And when they announced that Flair was going to fight Tatsumi Fujinami in Florida, I was sold because I just wanted to see some Japanese wrestlers. Mm-hmm. I mean, he'd had spots here with Muda and a little bit here and there, but I really, to me, it actually lured me in as, wow, this is a big deal. This is a big deal, Flair fighting this guy in the States.
So how long had you been watching WCW up until this point, 1991?
Not long, because it wasn't available. So I would say maybe a year, maybe two. No, actually, that's not true. Probably about 2 or 3 years, because I do remember going. They did a show at the CNE in 1989 when Flair was in the WWF and Sting was world champion at that time. So I would say probably like around from 89 or so. So wow, two okay. or 3 years.
Okay, yeah. So at least, you know, I mean, I was just trying to make the point that, you know, despite maybe not watching for it, but 3 years is quite a while. But despite all that, you saw this matchup and decided to not only watch the show but fly down to watch it in person.
Yeah, and I have to tell you what was going on here, because it was also bracketed by two. Like, it was an amazing weekend for me, because on the Thursday, we flew out on the Friday, on the Thursday here in Toronto, one of my favorite bands of all time, Hawkwind, were playing. So, and then on the Monday, we came back on the Monday, and that very night we got back, Motorhead was playing.
Wow.
So to me, it was a huge weekend. I'm going to see Hawkwind, I'm going to go to Florida for a weekend and see wrestling, and I'm going to come back and see Motorhead. Now, the only sad part about it was, unfortunately, right before we left, the Motorhead concert got canceled because Lemmy hurt himself or something. But for me, this was a really, really big deal this weekend. It was just like, wow, two of my favorite bands, and going to see WCW for the, you know.
And your idol, Rick Flair.
Yeah, exactly, and getting to see Flair. And I was really pumped for Luger and Sting against the Steiners. There were a couple other matches, obviously not Sid and El Gigante, but there were a couple. Oh, the Doom match with Simmons and Reed, I was pumped for that.
You weren't pumped for El Gigante?
No, I wasn't.
All right, this show is from, coincidentally, St. Petersburg,
that's
Florida.
Right. Yep.
Well, not Florida, but St. Petersburg, where our own John Pollock is right now.
Yeah, the other one.
Yes, the other one.
And also, and I just want to put this into, also the home of the Salvador Dali Museum. So how about this way? On Sunday, Saturday, yeah. We went to the Salvador Dali Museum. Sunday, we went and saw wrestling. I was in heaven.
Yeah, wrestling is sort of surreal. And
absolutely. It was on this show,
perfect. Your commentators are Jim Ross and Dusty Rhodes. What did you think of Dusty as a commentator?
He's not very good. Yeah. He doesn't seem to know how to get the matches and the guys over. I just get the impression, even back then, that Dusty's just talking. Dusty's not. I don't get the impression that he's really doing his best to get the guys over. And he was Booker at this time.
Right. I felt like. Maybe I was a little distracted by the delivery, because I find his delivery very captivating.
Yeah.
But you could be right. I, to be honest, didn't really listen closely enough to be able to gauge whether or not he was actually getting guys over.
Right, right.
I just thought, well, okay, this guy sounds...
I've got a couple lines we'll refer to as we go through from Dusty that were pretty funny.
All right, let's start off. First match on the show, we have, for the vacant WCW US Tag Team titles, the Fabulous Freebirds coming out with DDP and Big Daddy Dink.
Yes.
Sir Oliver Humperdinck.
Yeah.
Versus Steve and Tracy, Steve Armstrong and Tracy Smothers, the Young Pistols.
Right.
Do you have many memories of this?
Era? Well, because it was the opening match. Well, this, again. At this time, on one of the WCW syndicated shows, Michael Hayes and Jimmy Garvin and Lance Russell all did the commentary together, and I thought they were really, really funny. They totally played off each other great, and they were very fun. So I was kind of interested in seeing the Freebirds, but this is long past their prime Freebirds, right? Mm. Like this, they're not in their best shape at this point or anything. And the match itself, I remember, because it was the opening match, and it was very excited. We were all excited about it, but watching it again now, it wasn't really that great of a match.
Explain to me Big Daddy Dink. What is this?
I can't remember if there was an issue where they didn't want to use Sir Oliver Humperdinck. I think there was something going on where they didn't want to use that name, and so they called him Big Daddy Dink instead.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, this is for the vacant U.S. Tag Team titles, as I mentioned. The match starts off, Big Daddy Dink is interfering a lot on the outside, which prompts Brad Armstrong, the brother of Steve, who to come out and to basically equalize. At some point, Big Daddy Dink is then ejected and becomes a straight two-on-two matchup. Some fans start chanting Bad Street, and JR acknowledges this, citing that.
I'll just say something there. If anyone wants to see me in the crowd, if you look at the, if you look at that shot, because if you remember, once the crowd starts chanting Bad Street, they cut to the crowd chanting it. I'm in there.
Are you chanting Bad Street?
I'm in there. Chanting Bad Street. The big, you can see the big beer in my
hand. Oh my God, that's that will definitely be the.
I want us. Maybe we should have a contest to see who can spot the mouth in that match.
Well, I'm going to win because I'm going to find it. I'm going to use it as the album art for this.
Podcast. Perfect.
There you go. Young Dan Lavransky. So, what is it? Steve Armstrong comes in, gets the hot tag. Both Young Pistols go up for missile drop kicks from opposite corners, and they both miss. The Pistols with a number of tag team moves. We saw like a heart attack type of move with a missile dropkick instead of a clothesline. A ref bump results from one of these, and then some dude in a crow outfit comes out.
You know what?
Not the Sting Crow.
No.
Like a crow.
Yeah, no, I know. It was ridiculous. And as I rewatched it, I don't remember that. I don't remember that run-in. And I was trying to think back angle-wise to what that was in reference to, and I cannot for the life of me know what that had to do.
I did some reading on the show, of course, and I think it was actually Brad Armstrong that was in that crow outfit.
Mm.
So turning on his siblings, basically. In a crow outfit.
Yeah.
Like how inconspicuous.
Yeah, that was one thing about WCW. They liked weird costumes, as we'll see later in the show.
So he comes in during the ref bump, attacks, and he lays out the Young Pistols. When the ref comes to, the Freebirds make the pin, and they win the vacant U.S. tag team titles.
Yeah, back then, they used to have two sets of tag titles. They got rid of it eventually, but I think that's a holdover from one of the territories, U.S. tag belts.
Weren't there simply a lot more tag teams to the point where can do secondary tag team titles?
Yes. Yeah, there was a lot more tag teams back then, absolutely, yeah.
Now you can't even really have one.
No, exactly.
The main tag team titles are the secondary tag team titles. Up next, we got Dan Spivey versus Ricky Morton. There are a lot of rock and roll gimmicks of this time.
Yeah, WCW always embraced that stuff very heavily. And in some instances, I thought better than the WWF because you had guys like Michael Hayes, who was so good at that Southern rock kind of thing and the Freebirds theme, Bad Street, and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, Ricky Morton with the Rock and Roll Express. I think because they were Southern-based, they embraced it a little bit more than they did in the North.
Now, how many of these guys could actually play instruments?
Michael Hayes could sing. I don't know if he could actually play the guitar or not. As far as the Rock and Roll Express, no, I don't think they know anything about playing music, no.
Maybe they could DJ.
Do a little scratching on the turntable.
Everybody could DJ. Not a big deal. We have Dan Spivey here with the Heat. He delivers his razor's edge to Ricky Morton. Morton then gets a brief comeback. And then a powerbomb finish from Spivey.
Yeah, very quick match.
3 minutes.
Yeah, the best thing I liked about I think Spivey's one of those guys that really kind of got wasted, you know? Mm-hmm. Big guy, was good in the ring. I mean, very much like a Barry Windham.
He sort of did the Bray Wyatt gimmick before Bray Wyatt.
Right, that's right, that's right. When what did they call
Waylon
him?
Waylon Mercy.
Right, Waylon Mercy. Yeah. But I just liked him. He was in a tag team called the Skyscrapers, which was with Sid. And I just thought he was one of those guys, especially in the South where, you know, Barry Windham was used so well. And he was very much like Barry Windham. I don't really understand why they didn't use him more.
He just has, like, a creepy face.
Yes, he does.
Like, there's no way that this guy could be a good guy at all. Like, he just looks like a child molester.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. You're very, very true. He's very creepy looking, yeah.
Ricky Morton with a powerbomb, stands atop of him with one foot, and that was that. We got Tony Schiavone here. Did you catch all these in between?
Oh, yeah, man. This stuff is great.
Tony Schiavone is with Missy Hyatt and the Z-Man, Tom Zink. Tom Zink has been out for the last 6 weeks with the torn biceps. They're really like building this guy like he was a big deal. I never watched WCW at this time, but was Tom Zink that?
Yes, he
that
was.
Big of an attraction?
They were definitely trying to build him as one of the hot baby faces along with Brian Pillman.
Mm,
yeah.
Okay. So Tom Zink here is just talking, not wrestling tonight. They actually conducted a hotline poll asking the question whether or not Missy Hyatt would go back to the dressing room to conduct another interview after a debacle of an attempt trying to get an interview and then instead meeting tobacco chewing Stan Hansen who kicks her out of the locker room?
Right.
This was the hotline question.
Yeah, this was an angle that they ran for a little while with Missy about just her trying to get into the locker room to interview guys.
Well, her goal was to become the first woman to ever get an interview in pro wrestling. But the way she was going about it, I mean, just storming into men's locker rooms, I don't know.
Yeah, well, they had done it on the pay-per-view previously,
Wrestle
I believe.
War.
Right, and then they do it again here, as we'll see later on.
Okay. 60% voted yes, for those of you who care. Next up, we got Nikita Koloff taking on Tommy Rich. Can you explain, like, you know, the Tommy Rich identity to me? Because I see him, and for somebody like me, I associate that look with Ric Flair.
Right.
The same hair, same boots, same tights.
Right.
But, like, who was the originator? Like, why? There are, like, a number of guys who look like that.
Right.
Like
well, it was a popular look, you know, to dye your hair blonde was a very popular look.
But almost in that same cut? You know what I mean? With the robe.
Well, again, I think it was the style at the time. The thing with Tommy Rich is he had a real brief period where he was NWA champion. I don't know if you know this, but he got the big push. And the rumor was always that it was Jim Barnett. And Jim Barnett always kind of thought that he was
– Oh.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
And so Jim Barnett kind of put the push on Tommy Rich, and he actually won the NWA title. But it fizzled huge with the fans. And this is back – this is – like, maybe 10 years before this. Like, this is not peak Tommy Rich. At this period, he's merely just a fill-in player. He wasn't even involved in any major angles at this point in the promotion. He's really just a filler guy at this point. And you can almost say the same for Nikita. His hot days were in Mid-Atlantic with Koloff and that, and he's kind of on his way down, too.
This was a very quick match with Koloff just dominating, and then Rich getting a brief comeback. And then, just like the last match, out of nowhere, Koloff just Irish whips Rich into the ropes and then meets him with his Russian sickle.
Yes.
Which is
a lariat.
You know, like a lariat for the win at 427.
Yeah. That's these were just some of these early matches, just filler matches, you know.
Johnny B. Badd.
This was awesome. This was totally awesome. I loved this.
I assume this was cut out from the home video.
Yes, they didn't put this on the video, but this was the introduction of this character, and I loved this character. I thought Johnny B. Badd was awesome.
Did you from the get-go?
Yes, absolutely. Because I just bought one of his records. I love Little Richard.
Yeah.
I think Little Richard is one of those great 50s rock and roll performers. Always had an outrageous persona, crazy, and I thought Mark Marrow did a great job as Johnny B. Badd.
As an impression, like I don't know if the story's ever come out after that, but like let's think about the booking meeting where they come up with this character.
Yeah,
like this guy walks in, he looks just like Little Richard.
Yep.
So. Let's I wouldn't make be him
surprised. I wouldn't be surprised if I don't know who came up with it. I wouldn't be surprised if it was Hayes or Dusty.
Yeah,
I bet you one of those two probably came up with the
idea. He certainly like played it off well, and like you know,
I thought he was amazing, and he had Teddy Long, like Teddy Long, and this is Teddy Long in his prime. Mm-hmm. Like to me, this is Teddy Long in his prime when he was managing in the early '90s in WCW. He had the amazing gift of the gab, and I thought the promo the two cut is amazing.
They call out PN News, calls him.
Do you know who PN News is?
I do, yes.
Okay, because it was the terrible... This is one thing about WCW that always kind of made me laugh, is that they did jump on things quickly, but they were always terrible. Like this, I mean, the 1991 rap way. Yeah. I mean, this is the very early days, right? And PN News was a huge, big guy that, was a rap.
There's a lot of music influence in all this stuff.
Yeah, and definitely in WCW, yeah.
They called PN News an ugly bear.
He's a big old bear. Yeah.
They talk about Teddy Long talks about how Johnny B. Badd has the fastest hands in pro wrestling and that he's the only real man in pro wrestling.
Yeah,
despite being in a full makeup and a boa. Dusty, who you know initially says, I like this guy. After they come back from the promo, Dusty says, perhaps he's taken the flamboyancy a little too far.
I just loved it, and I loved the Johnny B. Badd signature lines, like at the end there, that became one of his signature lines.
Which
when he
was
goes,
what?
I'm so pretty, I should have been born a little girl. Yeah. He used to say that all the time. Mm. And he would go, oh, hush, Teddy. And that it's just like Little Richard.
It was quite jarring for me, like when he made the jump to the WWF as Mark Mero.
Yeah.
Like straight up, you know.
Yes, he's a very different character.
Manly boxer.
Yeah.
Because I had always, you know, like he was very identifiable. I mean, I would say probably. even to this point, like his career highlight is probably this character.
For me, it is. Yeah. I loved Johnny B. Badd. I thought it was a great character. I thought it was one of those times when they took music and they did it right. He was always fun to watch. He wasn't a bad worker in the ring. But again, they didn't really treat him that great in WCW. They didn't really push him the way they should have. They kind of established him.
Do you think there's potential for as a main eventer with a gimmick like that?
It's hard. It's hard sometimes if it's too comedic to be in the main event. But I do think he should have been pushed more than he was. Yeah, I do. I just thought it was, you know, and you had, you know, you're always in this type of thing. They were always leaning towards Elvis. You know, you had Honky Tonk Man, you had Lawler. It was always towards Elvis. I love that it was Little Richard instead. Mm. I thought that was great.
Up next, we have WWE Tag Team Champion Dustin Rhodes.
Now, this is the match that I really want to get your thoughts on.
All right.
Because this was friggin' crazy.
We have the natural Dustin Rhodes taking on Terry Taylor as the computerized man of the 1990s.
I knew you. Seriously, I knew you would. I'm like, I can't wait to see what weight.
I knew of this gimmick, of course, from like WrestleCrowd, but I'd never seen it in action. Though.
Okay.
The computerized man of the 90s with Alexandra York, who many people know as Marlena, and Mr. Curtis Hughes accompanying him. Explain this to me. This is a man, and I guess with that, Alexandra York as well, who has her. I don't even know what this was. Was this a laptop or like?
Well, back
a
then
note,
there's no
notebook?
Such. It was the impression is that it's a laptop, but back then there was nothing like laptops
anyway,
at that point.
She has this like
tablet. It looks
tablet,
like a tablet
computer, and the gimmick is that she is able to calculate on the fly his strategy on how to win a match using computers.
Yeah.
I mean, I was sick. I was eight. I was 8 years old at the time. I didn't really have much of a concept of, you know, computers or anything. But
no one did, though. Way this is 1991. It's still very much in the gray for a lot of people.
But
right?
You can at least tell me, what did the world think that these computers, this word computer, what was it capable of? Because I know from history, you can't even fit a text document on one of those. Like floppy, big floppy disks. And I imagine that's what they'd be using here.
Yeah, oh no, absolutely. The early computers were the size of a room, like, right? You know, like it's crazy. Again, I think it's just like PN News, is that WCW would jump on stuff that was new, but then they would just handle it in such a ridiculous way, you know?
What would be the equivalent today of like this Terry Taylor computerized man of the 1990s? Like, what's a mysterious technology available right now that we don't really understand, but in the future we'll look back and we'll say, wow, we are way off. That's so stupid.
Well, that's a good one because, I mean, I don't know.
Holograms.
I don't know. Even that's not that new, is it, really?
I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah.
That's Terry Taylor, the computerized. Was he a robot? Like, did he have computers within him?
No, but the idea, I think it was the only way they could make him a heel. Like, I mean, Terry Taylor was such a good baby face, right? I mean, especially before this. He was a very good baby face, and they tried to turn him heel, and it didn't really work. I mean, they called him Terrence Taylor instead of Terry. And did you notice he had his hair all slicked back, and he'd wear a suit during his promos and stuff?
Would it not have been great if, like, mid-match, Alexander York like plugs in a cable.
Yes. Well, and you know what? That would not surprise me if WCW would do something like that because they had that stuff like with RoboCop and all that kind of silliness. So I just thought the perception of the computer was hilarious that the heels had the computer. Like, you know, something now that we would talk about the benefits and how much computers and technology have changed our life for the better. But I thought it was amazing that the heels had the computer. I thought that was pretty funny.
It's sort of, like, in a way, it's almost like they're cheating, you know? Like,
yeah.
They're using, like, unnatural.
Well, and that was the premise of the gimmick, right? Yeah. She's got an advantage with her computer. But you know what? You know what she used a computer for most of the time?
No.
She'd cork the guys with it.
Yeah.
It wasn't really about getting data. It was another thing that you could hit your opponent with.
Yeah. Dustin Rhodes is undefeated in WCW at this time, only 21 years old.
Yeah, like, I mean, very young at this point.
I often feel like, you know, in this current run that he's having right now, to me, like, it seems like this guy's been around forever. He must be older, but he's only 44 right now. So
yeah. And the thing that's interesting is if you look at him here in 91 and how he looks now, he looks almost the same.
Yeah.
In terms of physical, I mean, in terms of
how
shape
he is.
The shape he's in.
He's much thinner now, but there was that time, you remember Black Rain?
Yes.
And like 7?
Yeah.
Where
yes.
he just like ballooned.
Yes, he did. That's right.
Yeah. So Dustin Rhodes, Dusty, of course, is on commentary here, and he's just talking about the strategy he's been working with his son, Dustin. York starts to calculate the game plan on the outside.
See, she would get all the things. She would tell him what move. She would calculate what move to do. Wait, yeah. And she'd whisper.
She was on Wikipedia in the future. Dustin goes for the bionic elbow, but instead they land in a headlock and he misses. Rhodes lands a big clothesline, an inverted atomic drop for two, then hits his finisher, the bulldog, for the win.
What? That's not what happened.
Oh, sorry. He didn't win. He just hit the finisher and he missed it.
Yeah, and then Mr. Hughes hit him with the glove, with the loaded black glove.
You're right. York distracts the ref from making the pinfall. And then, Terry Taylor and Curtis Hughes attack Rhodes from behind. Hughes reaches for his black glove, but Rhodes ducks out of the way and Taylor gets hit by Hughes with the glove instead. And 8 minutes, 5 seconds.
And did you catch Justy's line at there? He goes, I know what you can do with that computer, and I can't say it right here. That was Justy's comment on computers. So that match, I think, if you want to search out, and just for the way the computer is used, I think most people today would get quite the kick out of that.
Yeah. They should bring that back. Because I think now computers are actually capable of you know, probably helping.
Working that quickly and helping you. Yeah, I would think so.
Big Josh versus Black Bart here. Big Josh comes out with two bears.
Not just one, but two.
Two, like...
Now, this I distinctly remember. I'm just like, I remember me and my buddies going, whoa, this guy's got two freaking bears
with
him.
Two live bears. Yes. I'm not talking about, like, two people in bear costumes.
Nope.
These are bears from the
Ringling
forest.
Brothers Circus, probably, or something.
They were walking upright.
Yes. Like, so they're obviously circus bears.
Yeah, these are like shackled bears to, like, you know, harnesses.
He was holding each one by the hand as, like, they walked beside him.
What the hell is this? Like, and what did this have to do with pro wrestling?
Well, wait, come on now. You know the history of the wrestling bear in professional wrestling.
But this was not that. This was
no. But this is the. I think this is just the remnants of that. Plus the idea that his character was a lumberjack. He's living in, who owns pet bears. He's living in the woods. Hey, listen, David McKinley, who had the wrestling bear. The bear lived with him all year round. It would sleep under his porch at his house, and then he would take the bear out on tours, and they would wrestle. That'd be great
if these bears actually wrestled.
Yeah,
these were just
to show. Big Josh was his lumberjack, and he's got his bears.
Just think about the trouble of getting two bears flown into whatever town they were in.
Keeping them, well, St. Petersburg, keeping them back. But see, that's the thing, though. I bet you the bears were from a local circus in Florida. I don't think they were flown in.
I hope so. But then, just what? For like the 20 seconds of the walk?
Yep.
I mean, you actually remembered this, but I mean, I'd be hard pressed for all the wrong reasons. You remembered this.
Well, exactly. The fact that there's two live bears in a friggin' giant arena full of people here.
This was a sort of a slow match here. Big Josh, he's got a big move that he calls the log roll, where he stomps on his opponent repeatedly, like running on his opponent, like
he's rolling on a log roll.
This match, I didn't think was very good. It was a lot of slow heavyweight brawling. Big Josh basically just hits the earthquake splash for the win,
which JR called the big butt.
The big butt drop.
Yeah.
Did any part of you while you were there ask why this was on a pay-per-view?
No, but WCW would do this on pay-per-views once in a while because he was a relatively new character. So it was more just, I think, to get him out there for the fans type of thing more than anything else.
Do you think they booked any of these shows knowing that, you know, like eventually on the home video cassette they would have to cut out a lot of this stuff?
I don't think so. I don't think so because the shows, it was pay-per-view, right? So the idea was you did a 3-hour show for a pay-per-view. I think it's more they're just there to pad out the show.
Like, yeah, that's what I mean. It just seems like there's a lot of filler.
I think you're right.
Next up, we got Paul Heyman with the Danger Zone.
Yeah, I wanted to see what you thought of this.
Paulie Dangerously with the Danger Zone and his guest tonight. This was a young and thin Paul Heyman, by the way. He's dressed up in
and
a cowboy.
He's still wearing a hat. He's starting to hide his hair already, but he's got fairly long hair.
Yeah, yeah. He was dressed up in a cowboy hat here because his guest today is Stan Hansen. Stan Hansen immediately just comes in and there's a giant, nasty glob of black tobacco, like, dripping
huge
out of his
chunk
mouth.
Of chaw. Huge chunk of chaw, like, way past what any normal tobacco-chewing person would use. The most, in fact, most people that chew tobacco, they keep it inside their mouth. But that was the Stan Hansen this gimmick. And he never did this anywhere else, Way. He never wrestled in Japan with a big fucking chunk of chaw.
Why is that?
Chaw. Well, because it wasn't needed in Japan. In Japan, they respected him as a big, tough, strong guy. In here, of course, WCW, everything gets turned to a caricature, right?
Everything's so, a lot more.
Oh, yeah, he's the loud Texan with the big chunk of chaw. Like, look at his delivery. He yells every single one of his lines. You know, that's the North American influence. And also the reason he probably wasn't in WCW for very long.
This was exactly the character he was playing in Ready to Rumble.
Yes, that's true, yeah.
With the big thing. Stan Hansen calls out Dustin Rhodes and tells him to stop hiding behind his dad. So that looks like their next program.
And Heyman, and it was funny, too, because Heyman is the heel here. He's kind of taunting him. And Hansen is the babyface, which is kind of strange.
Was Hansen the babyface?
Oh, yeah. Come on. Did you listen to what Heyman
was calling out Dustin Rhodes?
No. But, well, yeah, that's true. But Heyman was totally making fun of Hansen, if you noticed. He's like, oh, look, I'm wearing my cowboy hat because you're a big, bad cowboy and all that.
I thought he was kind of doing it in support.
I don't think so. I got the impression he was making fun of him.
Up next, my highlight of this show.
Yeah, I knew you'd love this.
The debut of Oz.
Yep.
Kevin Nash.
Yes.
Let's just set the scene here.
This was crazy live. Like, this was just ridiculous.
Did you expect this?
No.
Did they promote Oz?
No. I don't believe there were any vignettes leading into Oz. I could be wrong, though. Okay. I don't remember any, no.
Do you know the backstory behind, like, why this was even done?
No. I think they were trying to find gimmicks for Nash, right?
Is there not a story out there that said Turner got the rights to Wizard of Oz?
That could be. That wouldn't surprise me. Yep, he probably did. He probably got the rights to the movie, and maybe he went to them and said, I want a Wizard of Oz character.
Anyway, the lights dim in the arena. This green laser starts shooting out. There's dry ice, like this amusement park medieval music starts playing.
Yeah.
And then a voiceover, which sounded a lot like Kevin Nash.
I think it was.
Once upon a time, in a land far away, there lived a wizard, but not the Wizard of Oz. His name was the Great Wizard. And he ruled the Kingdom of Oz.
Like, what? I know.
Poorly
written. Makes no sense. Makes no fucking sense at all.
Poorly written.
No fucking sense at all. Nope. I'm a wizard. I'm not the Wizard of Oz, but I'm the Wizard of Oz. Did you notice the crowd's reaction?
I was too busy
laughing your head off.
Laughing my own reaction. There's dry ice. We see a lion, a tin man, a scarecrow. And a Dorothy.
Yep.
I'm not making any of this
up. No, it's true. I was there.
They start walking down the ramp towards the ring, and then they turn back in fear of Oz. And Oz, what did Oz look like?
It was hilarious. He had a huge, giant green robe on. He had a huge, giant green kind of pointed Merlin the Magician kind of hat. And he had a big, huge, friggin' giant white beard.
And a mask. Like, he was actually wearing a mask.
Yeah, and a fake beard and everything. Yeah, that's
right. So, like, basically, like an 8-foot-tall cloak and then a mask.
And he was obviously wearing lifts in his shoes, too, because he was really tall.
He looked really tall.
Yeah.
Like, ridiculously... not intimidating, like goofy tall.
Yeah.
I was just amazed because they spared no expense, clearly, for this entrance. This was, like, quite extravagant.
Oh, they had a monkey.
They did.
Did you catch that? Kevin Sullivan had the freaking monkey.
Probably came with a bear.
They got a deal. They got a rate at this. Yeah. They got a rate, special rate from the circus.
They built a castle here for his backdrop.
The best part about it that I loved was the crowd, and I remember this, the crowd fucking booed it out of the building. If you go back and watch it, as soon as it starts, as soon as you see the Wizard of Oz characters, the crowd is booing huge. They booed it out of the building. I don't know, because Sullivan was involved, and he was an ideas guy at that point, too. I don't know.
You had Jim Hurd there as well?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if he was involved with this angle at all or coming up with it, but they had him. He was kind of the guy leading Oz out afterwards. But
he was the wizard?
Yeah.
He played the wizard.
Yeah, he was the guy with the monkey. That was Sullivan.
Oh,
yeah.
God.
So I'm not sure if he was involved. But yeah, it was – I liked that that's in there because it is a debut of a character that you constantly hear about. You know, you hear a lot about Nash's early days, Master Blaster. He did several different things before they got it. He just kind of let him be himself kind of thing, right? And I just think it's great that you can actually still see that. Because to me, that's a little bit – it's a small bit, but it's a small bit of, like, wrestling history.
I just want – yeah, absolutely it was. I mean, I just want to – like, how does this even get made? How does this get, first of all, like, get greenlit?
Seriously, back then, way in WCW, despite the fact that they would have, you know, guys like Arn or Flair and Wyndham would have these wicked great matches, you had a lot of silly stuff. There was a tag team called the Ding Dongs, who were just two big furry guys and big fat guys in furry outfits. Like, you had a lot of weird stuff. I mean, Arachnaman, for God's sake.
Yeah.
Was one of the Armstrong brothers as Arachnaman in a blue and yellow knockoff Spider-Man costume.
Like, future review.
You had a lot of weird stuff back then.
Oz gets in the ring, takes off the mask to reveal Kevin Nash's white dyed hair and white dyed goatee. his opponent. What was his name?
Tim Parker.
Tim Parker was just in the ring. Didn't
Job
even,
guy. Yeah, jobber
get,
guy.
Didn't get an entrance. Nash delivers this big, you know, helicopter swing from a gory backbreaker for the win at 26 seconds. This was one of the most ridiculous entrances I'd ever seen in my life.
Yeah, we pretty well felt the same way there live. It was just ridiculous.
That's worth that was worth the price of admission.
Well, you know what? That stuff was funny, you know.
Missy Hyde is backstage. She's trying to get a locker room interview, so she just storms in there in the men's locker room, and instead of finding the Z-Man, she finds Terry Taylor.
The computerized man of the 90s.
Yeah, without his computer.
No, he was just sitting there. Yeah, I know.
She doesn't really care what he says, but instead he's interested in looking for the Z-Man for some reason. He starts looking for the Z-Man in the shower, but instead, again, it's Stan Hansen.
Yep.
Coming out of the shower.
Still with the char in his mouth.
Yes. And for some reason, deciding, I'm naked. I better put on my cowboy hat. That was the first thing he reached for. So that's that. Up next, we have a taped fist match with Flying Brian Pillman versus Barry Windham. Explain the concept of a taped fist match.
It's an old school match, like an old school kind of gimmick, like the miner's glove on a pole or Texas death match. The idea that you would tape each other's fists so it would be more brutal of a match, and you wouldn't hurt yourself from punching. So you know there's going to be a lot of punching and aggressive brawling in that type of match. It's kind of like a brawler kind of match.
Okay.
Yeah.
To protect the fists.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Barry Windham is busted on his forehead early on, presumably hard way. I didn't really see how it happened. We just go to the finish right now. Brian Pillman goes up to the top, but Barry Windham tosses the ref to the side, and Windham low blows Pillman up on the top and goes up and delivers his superplex to Pillman and covers him for the win at 6 minutes and 8 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, not the best match for either guy. I love that superplex that Windham used to do. Mm-hmm. I thought he always
rolls over into the
cover. That's it. He with the way his body was and the momentum, yeah, he would just flip right over and pin the guy. And I always thought it was great. And Pillman, he's playing the baby face at this point. But again, another amazing performer that I thought really got the short end of the stick in WCW a lot of the time. Mm. He was a great baby face. He was an even better heel. And then when he was finally starting to get somewhere with him and Austin, when they were tagged as the Hollywood Blondes, because it got over, they said, oh, well, that's you guys are getting over. Forget it. And they broke them up. And then that was it. He was kind of out of there after that. But so he was a guy that I thought was vastly underused, you know.
Up next, we have the Battle of the Giants in a stretcher match. The loser must leave the ring on a stretcher. Am I correct?
Yes.
That was the stipulation they announced, right?
That was the stipulation
they
announced.
I'm not making that up.
No.
So keep that in mind.
Yes.
First, we have, from anywhere he darn pleases, Big Sid Vicious. He is taking on the largest athlete in the world, El Gigante, Giant Gonzalez to WWF fans.
Right. Now, you know the story on El Gigante, right? Is that Ted Turner brought El Gigante in from Brazil. I think that's where
Argentina.
It was. Argentina. Yeah. And he wanted to put him on his on the Braves basketball team, right?
Oh, you mean the Hawks? Atlanta Hawks?
The Atlanta. That's why he was brought in, for basketball. Turner thought he was going to be a huge basketball star, and when they got him out there on the court, they found that, he's no
good. Being tall is not enough to be able to
that's
compete?
Right. It's not just being
Michael
tall.
Jordan?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's not just being tall. They found that he couldn't play a lick, so that's when he ended up in WCW, because Turner wanted to use him somehow to get his money back, right? So there you go.
Wow.
Yeah.
Like, what other profession, I mean... anywhere else, you bring a 7-foot guy over to your country to work for you. If he doesn't work out in one place, it's not like you have many other options to put him. But Ted Turner happened to have the two places that would actually employ a 7-foot something.
That's right.
Gargantuan.
And unfortunately, he didn't do very good in either one.
No, he did not. El Gigante comes in carrying the stretcher with one hand.
Yeah.
Just lifts it with one hand. He made Sid look so tiny here.
And Sid's a big guy.
Oh, obviously, yeah. And in contrast, the referee that was in there with him looked like a 2-year-old. El Gigante, JR talks about, was a former Argentinian basketball superstar.
Yeah, there
apparently.
You go. I don't know about that.
A lot of elbow drops and collar tie-ups in here. Sid was basically having to carry this match.
But if you could, and think about that.
Yeah, Sid was starting to attack the legs of El Gigante. Sid charges into the corner, but Gigante meets him with the big boot. And then Gigante delivers the Iron Claw.
I know.
For the victory.
Because that's about all he could do for a finisher.
In a stretcher match, delivers the Iron Claw for the pinfall. He wins. And that was the end of the stretcher match.
Yes.
The stretcher played no part in this.
Yes, that's right. It does in the beatdown here afterwards.
In the beatdown, but that wasn't the point of the match. One Man Gang and Kevin Sullivan, not in Wizard outfit.
No.
Immediately
no
run
monkey.
In. No monkey either. Immediately we run in to attack El Gigante. Gigante takes both men out. And then I found it very strange here, because this is the part where Gigante starts to put One Man Gang on the stretcher. And Sullivan actually helps him.
I think that's because he knew El Gigante couldn't do it.
Yeah.
Yep.
But
yep.
It was weird.
I know. The heel manager's helping the babyface beat up the heel.
And then he starts attacking him.
Yeah.
I'm going to help
you
right now, and then I'm going to attack you.
I got to tell you something that happened live here that you did not get to see.
Okay.
Because this was brilliant.
Yeah.
Right after it was finished and Sid had lost and the run-in begins, Sid just rolled out of the ring and he got right up and he sold nothing and walked to the back. It was so funny. You could tell. And I believe Sid was done with the company at this point, too.
Oh, okay.
I think that's why the match was so quick and everything, because Sid was on his way out.
Right.
And it was the best way. I remember sitting there, and the running is starting, and I'm looking, and like, Sid is selling nothing. He just walks off, walks to the back, not hurt, not nothing. That was it.
Where were you sitting?
We were ringside.
Right ringside.
We were on the opposite side of the ramp. So you don't really see us
where the commentators
too
are.
Much. That's right.
Right behind the commentators.
That's right. We were behind the commentators. Probably, I think it was like fourth or fifth row. We were pretty close.
I will say I thought El Gigante looked passable. Like, to me, he was more mobile than Kali here.
Right, right.
And they were trying to book him strong. So, I mean, obviously it didn't really go much further than where it did. We continue on with the show here. And up next we have Ron Simmons taking on Hacksaw Butch Reed. This was the end of a feud between two partners.
Right. They'd been the tag team Doom. And this was the Thunder Doom cage match to get their... And Teddy Long suspended above the cage.
Teddy Long was in a mini cage up top.
Yes.
This
looks
ridiculous but hilarious.
This was something that was done fairly regularly back then. In Memphis, they did countless angles with Jerry Lawler and Jimmy Hart, where Jimmy Hart would be suspended over the ring and the winner, Lawler, would get his hands on him afterwards and stuff like that. It was kind of the idea to keep him away from helping the heel, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, you couldn't just keep the guy locked in the cage outside. You have to suspend him like in the middle
I thought
of the
it. I liked the idea that it was suspended.
It was quite the
spectacle. Because it built some drama, and then certainly when you lower it, once the face wins, you got all that drama.
We didn't get that, though.
No, that's true. We didn't.
All right, so this was, I felt another pretty slow, you know, plotting type of match with a lot of rubbing each other's faces into the cage, taking a lot of time to sell.
There was color in this match too, I think, wasn't it? In fact, you could tell when Ron Simmons is gigging if you watch. It's very obvious.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Reed here was being pushed as the veteran, having been in many cage matches, while Ron Simmons was portrayed by JR, somebody younger with a little less experience. Reed comes off the top with the shoulder block, but Simmons gets his foot on the rope for two. Simmons gets his comeback, but he's thwarted by a high knee from Butch Reed. Long, at this point, tosses a chain. That's why you should put, you know, these managers on the outside, and they can just toss.
Yeah.
Toss
well, see, that would be it. that was usually what the gimmick that happened, right? Is the heel manager would have something he was trying to throw to his guy.
Teddy Long tosses a chain from the ring above, down below. This is all apparently legal. I found that odd too.
No, well, but didn't you catch what they said after the match?
They said in a steel cage match, there's no DQ.
Yeah.
Is that what he said?
They didn't. This just shows you WCW. They didn't mention until the match was over that it was no DQ.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and it was almost like Schiavone felt he had to justify what. Like if you listen to his tone, you can tell that he was trying to justify.
I mean, Jim Ross
was. Oh, sorry. Yeah, sorry, Jim Ross. He was trying to justify what happened because he kind of sneaks it in there quick before they move on to the next thing. Yeah. You know.
Butch Reed misses with the chain, and then he heads right into a spinebuster from Ron Simmons, who gets the win at 9 minutes, 39 seconds.
Yeah, you know, and going into this, I was actually looking forward to this, and it wasn't, it didn't
this
really.
This was supposed to be the culmination of the years.
Yeah,
right?
it really didn't deliver. Again, they were another team that I really enjoyed. I kind of think they probably shouldn't have been broken up. They're another one where I thought the breakup came a little too soon.
Do you think that it was just because they wanted to push Ron Simmons? Eventually?
I think so, yes, I think so. They wanted, I mean, they had been around for a while. They debuted under Hoods with Woman as their manager, and then they were eventually with Teddy Long. My favorite thing was Doom, probably about a year before or so, they had a great feud with the Horsemen with some amazing vignettes with them attacking. There's this one where Flair won a match. No, Arn won the match, and Flair got to have Teddy Long as his chauffeur for the entire day. And it was a brilliant vignette. Flair just drove Teddy Long nuts, and the whole idea was Teddy Long took him somewhere out in the boondocks, and Simmons and Reed were waiting, and they beat the crap out of Flair. It was really good, and it was the excellent way to do that type of vignette, you know?
Up next, we got the Steiner brothers taking on Sting and Lex Luger, who the Steiners at this point were the tag team champions,
yes,
right?
Yes.
This was a story basically, building a friendly rivalry. Between
that's right. This beforehand, this was totally sold as babyface versus babyface, mm-hmm. and there were no heels. It was the idea that, Steiners are the best team right now. Sting and Luger have been buddies forever. They thought it would be good to tag them up and have this match. I wanted to ask you what you thought of the montage.
Yeah.
Okay, montage leading into it, because very different from what you would get today.
Yeah. Rather than, your typical, voiceover guy explaining everything that happened, or at least using clips of promos to tell a story.
Right.
This was pretty much just like a music video with slow-mo footage of these guys highlighting their friendship and then just highlighting their dominance. I mean, for something very different, I thought it was done very well.
Yeah. I liked the choice of music.
Yeah.
Almost like classical music,
You know what it felt? It felt like it was like I was watching like something on a Japanese show.
Right.
Where like they don't really, I mean, I probably don't understand what they're talking about anyway, but simply using the tone of the music to tell the story.
Right.
Oh, this is a good guy. This is a good guy.
And like the idea that this, because using the classical music, that this will be monumental.
Yeah.
This will be huge. This is the match everybody's wanted to see. That's how it was kind of sold.
It got me like pretty hyped for this. Like, and that's quite the feat, I don't know if it'll really work too well in today's environment.
Yeah, with, it's different.
Such slick production everywhere to just kind of do a little thing like this. It might not work, but for this show, I thought it was kind of cool. First up, we got Luger in there with Rick Steiner. JR portrays this as a matchup between the two power forces within the teams. Rick gets the better of Luger at the start with a German suplex and then a Steiner line. Luger comes back with a military press. Sting is in next, and Sting just, rushes in and kind of like reminiscent of, somebody like a Daniel Bryan today, just coming in with a lot of energy,
right,
a lot of fire.
Yep.
Takes the matchup to a whole new level. Plancha over the top ropes, hits Rick Steiner with a the power slam over the top rope, which is one of their own moves. Scott comes in now, delivers a butterfly suplex bomb to Sting. Both teams, I found, were equally cheered at the arena.
Well, yeah, absolutely. That's the way it was. No one was – it was one of those rare chances when a baby versus babyface thing worked. It usually doesn't work, right? Mm-hmm. And it really did in this situation. But they did a good job of building up. Like, I remember when we decided to go, this was definitely one of the matches that attracted me. Mm-hmm. Plus, you got to remember, too, Steiners were really – there weren't many teams like the Steiners at this point. You know, you weren't exposed to Japanese wrestling. You didn't see Frankensteiners and a lot of stuff that those guys would take from their days in Japan. And I just thought at that time, and plus Scott wasn't nearly as bulky, he could do a lot more. I just thought they were like one of the best teams of that era, you know?
Stinger splash on Scott right now, and then Sting's about to apply the Scorpion Deathlock when Nikita Koloff runs down to attack his nemesis, Lex Luger. Sting drops the Scorpion Deathlock and instead pushes his friend Luger out of the way, and he instead gets hit with Koloff's chain.
Yeah.
A lot of chains here. This, however, gives the Steiner Brothers the win when Scott pins Sting. Sting at this point is busted open. After the match, the Steiners look confused. They don't know what happened. Sting just ignores everything that just happened and decides to run to the back because he's so pissed off. Nikita Koloff is being interviewed by Tony Schiavone, but Sting just runs at him, and they start just brawling into the parking lot.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting, too, that Sting did color, because this was like the third match, not in a row, but third match already that had color.
Yeah. I don't know if the Wyndham
one was on purpose.
Was on purpose, right, or not.
The Ron Simmons one you could tell was, and this one obviously was too.
I thought the match was great.
Yeah, I did. I rewatching it again, it was even better than I remember from seeing it live. Yeah. But yeah, and despite having, you know, Luger, who's not a great performer, but you had three other guys in there that really, really could make it work. And I thought it was one of the better matches of the show.
I mean, I don't think it's easy to, you know, maintain equal babyface status for anytime you have a babyface versus a babyface, but they managed to do that very well here.
Yep.
Like it really felt like a matchup between two of my favorites. You know? It had like a real big match feel.
Yep.
Unfortunately, with a sort of a weak finish, but good match nonetheless. Up next, we have for the WCW World TV title, Arn Anderson, the champion, taking on beautiful Bobby Eaton.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to get any complaints from me when these two are in there. I mean, I love Arn, and Bobby Eaton is so underrated.
Was this a TV title run of Arn's, like, of any significance?
Oh, it ran for quite a while. The best thing about that, is you got to see Arn Anderson on TV every week, because they were quite good at having Arn defend the belt, and they had, like, these little mini programs that were just on TV. I remember distinctly, over 3 weeks of TV, Arn fighting Terry Taylor. And both guys came out of it just looking amazing. I think they did the first couple of matches were a draw, and then Arn won the last one finally. But it was actually a title that was, you know, definitely better than the U.S. or any of the ones today, right? Those secondary titles today.
And what was Bobby Eaton's storyline at the time?
At this time, well, like they said, it was basically him going for his first singles title, right? He had always been a tag team wrestler. You know, he'd been in all those different tag teams before. And, it was basically him for his first time trying for a singles title.
Well, our first big spot of the match, Bobby Eaton is on the top turnbuckle facing the outside.
The ramp.
Arn grabs him from the apron and just military presses him off the top turnbuckle onto the ramp.
Yeah. Yeah, it was crazy.
Looked brutal.
And remember, this is 1991. Yeah. There's no hardcore yet. There's no crazy guys going through tables and chairs. That was a big spot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, to this, if he did it today, it would be big.
Yeah.
Arn Anderson works on Bobby Eaton's left leg throughout the match. Eaton, at one point, attempts to try to suplex Arn, but collapses on his knee. The pace of the match starts to slow down here with some of the psychology. Eaton gets a comeback, hits his neck breaker, decides to go up to the top on his bad knee for his Alabama Jam, which is just a top rope leg drop.
Right.
And he lands it, and I thought a little odd. All of a sudden, his knee is better.
Yeah,
using
right.
it for his finish.
Right.
What did you think of the match?
I thought it was okay. I wasn't too crazy about the finish, though, again.
Do you think, like, was this supposed to be, like, a big moment of Arn, first of all, you know, losing the title and also Bobby Eaton winning the TV title for the first time?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. But that doesn't really come across, does
it? No, it didn't come across to me.
Well, not, I think, again, because of the ending. It should have just been a clean finish, right? Yeah. Really, honestly, there should have been no interference, right?
Yes, the interference comes when Barry Windham is here, but Brian Pillman comes in to make the save. These two really didn't have much effect, but Eaton basically just makes the cover. He's the new champion.
Yeah, see, the idea, I mean, Windham and Arn were tag team at that point, right? So that's why Windham's out there to help Arn, right?
I see.
The Horsemen tag team. And then Pillman, because they'd had the match earlier, just comes out to stop Windham. So that's why the interference. But I think it would have meant a hell of a lot more, especially since Arn held that belt for a long time. Mm-hmm. It would have been better if Eaton had just won clean.
Our main event is up next, and it pits WCW champion Ric Flair against IWGP NWA champion Tatsumi Fujinami. I'm really confused about the title situation.
Okay, let me explain what happened, right? Because happened is they had a big show in Japan called the Japan Super Show. And what happened at the main event on that was Flair versus Fujinami. And they basically did a dusty finish.
Well, who had what titles at that time?
Flair, I think it's the same. I think Flair had the NWA title, and I'm not sure if Fujinami, I'm assuming he did have the IWGP title at that time, right?
I believe that in that match, Fujinami won the NWA title.
See, this is what they did. He did and he didn't. They did a dusty finish, basically, right? What happened was they were having the match, and it was the same as this one. There was two refs. There was the American ref, Bill Alfonso, who everybody knows Fonzie, mm-hmm. and the Japanese ref. And what they did, basically, was Alfonso got knocked out of the ring, and then Flair got tossed over the top rope by Fujinami, which in Japan at that time was a disqualification, right? So the thing was, and Flair landed right in front of Alfonso, but Alfonso was knocked out on the outside, so he didn't notice it. So Flair got back in the ring, and they did a couple of exchanges, and Fujinami pinned Flair, and the Japanese official counted that pinfall. So the idea was... And then they did a press conference afterwards where Flair actually ran out, attacked Fujinami, and stole the belt and took it back with them to the U.S.
Okay.
And so that was the discrepancy. It's like, oh, we don't know who the champion is. Flair's got the belt. Fujinami, did he win the match or not? But really, it was basically a dusty finish.
Right,
because they didn't want to let Fujinami keep the belt for a while.
So going into this match, like, who are they recognizing as what? Like, because did Flair came out with the belt, too?
Because he stole it, right? That whole idea was that as the heel, he stole the belt. Fujinami has to come to North America to get the belt back from Flair, right?
I see. Can you tell me a little about, you know, WCW's relationship with New Japan at this time?
It was pretty good. It was pretty good at this time, Wei. You saw lots of good stuff. They did more than one Japan Super Show. The guys were constantly kind of coming back and forth. We got to see, I mean, Great Muda was in quite a bit earlier. We had a big feud with Sting and Terry Funk.
Steiners would go over there.
Yeah, Steiners went over quite... I mean, Wyndham, Flair, Arn, all those guys would go over... A lot of the WCW guys would work over in Japan. It was quite healthy at this point, yeah.
So let's get into the match. Fujinami comes out with a parade of girls in kimonos.
Flowers and everything, yeah.
Throwing flower petals on the ramp. Flair comes out with a maid, a chef, and somebody that I would assume, is his chauffeur or his butler. He puts his Rolex watch on a sterling silver tray.
I just want to mention, too, I don't know if you noticed, too, the guys were... We had Hiro Matsuda there.
Oh, okay.
With... Fujinami, and also Masa Saito was there with Fujinami as well.
Very cool. As you mentioned, Bill Alfonso here is one of the American referee.
Yes.
He's the backup official
this
match.
That's right.
They reversed the
roles. That's right. They have.
Tiger Hattori is the actual referee in the ring from Japan.
So, and did you notice, too, Flair's haircut?
No.
No, this is he had the short hair. This is after the infamous thing where Jim Herd made him cut his hair.
Oh, right.
And they wanted to give him that Spartacus gimmick.
Oh.
They wanted to give Flair a gimmick as Spartacus. Cut his hair, you know, dress him up like a Roman gladiator. Seriously, Wade, that's what they wanted to do with Flair.
Oh, God.
Yeah. That's awesome. Why Flair has the short hair at this point.
We go to the match. Flair goes straight for the chops. Fujinami gets Flair in a bow and arrow. JR makes mention of the back injury that Flair suffered in the plane crash that John and I talked about last week in our Jim Crockett review.
Yep.
Fujinami continues to work on the back with the Boston Crab. To me, this had a real feeling of a standard Japanese style match, starting kind of slow at the beginning and then working really. Yeah.
I can't stress
pace.
How much to me this felt like a big deal.
Yeah.
I wasn't really following wrestling closely yet. I wasn't reading The Observer and all that kind of stuff yet. But to me, this. It just had such a big – it really attracted me. It had a big match feel.
Was there a lot of buzz like where we are, like up in Toronto?
No, WCW at that point was really not known that well up here. Like I said, there was only the one syndicated show. TBS was not readily available at that point yet. Right. It wasn't until TBS really became readily available here that did you start to see more people getting into WCW. So there was no. In terms of up here, no.
But just as a fan, somebody who actually was keeping up with WCW, to you, it was absolutely.
It was the total reason I wanted to go. Like as soon as I saw Flair, I don't know, there was just the mystique of Flair fighting a Japanese wrestler, and I'd heard a little bit about wrestling in Japan. I didn't really know that much about it.
Yeah. I imagine like it'd be like Joe versus Kobashi for like my generation,
right? Yeah, for sure, yeah. Absolutely. It was one of those times when I thought, wow, you've really got something cool. Cool, special. I mean, I enough that I would fly down for the weekend to go see it. You know,
that's cool. Where are we? They brawl to the outside. Flair crotches Fujinami on the security rail. Flair begins to work on Fujinami's knee this time. He manages to apply the figure four, but Fujinami flips it over and reverses it.
I loved that spot. I thought the way they did it was so cool.
Now you tell me, because like I remember watching in a lot of Japanese matches where they don't buy into that concept of flipping over and having the figure four hurt the guy applying it.
Right.
Like I've seen in a lot of Japanese matches where they would just simply roll
and then
to
they
the ropes
kinda,
to,
yeah,
to
or
get
they get out of
it
or whatever. Yeah.
Like they don't do the thing where if you flip over, you're hurting.
They do in American wrestling. And I thought these two did a great job with it. I thought it was very convincing.
Back on the outside, Flair is busted open now. Of course, Fujinami applies the octopus stretch onto Ric Flair. Flair is basically selling for most of this because he was kind of working as a babyface here, defending, WCW and America.
You know what? I don't know about that. I think he's still the heel. He stole the title. My conception at the time was he was still the heel. He was upset that he didn't win the match in Japan, so he blatantly stole the title, went back to North America. I don't know. My eyes, he's still the heel.
Do you think this audience was cheering against him for this guy? I mean, before the match, they had the Fujinami's people were cutting a promo about how they want to take the title back to Japan.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't get that feeling, Wei. I don't know if the crowd felt that. I didn't get that feeling at all.
Clearly you're cheering against Flair then.
I mean, I loved Flair. I thought he was a great heel, but in terms of the storyline, I saw him as the heel and I saw Fujinami as the
baby. We'll talk a little bit more at the end of the match because I found it a little confusing myself.
Okay.
There are a series of near falls. Fujinami gets a roll-up, but Flair pushes him off into the referee, who takes a bump. At this point, Bill Alfonso, the backup referee, decides to step in. Flair schoolboys Fujinami. Of course he grabs the tights, makes the pinfall. So Ric Flair wins the title. And what I was a little confused by, I felt like this was definitely a heel finish. Ric Flair grabs the tights to win.
Yep.
And he has, the non-official coming to make the count for him. But I found on the commentary, they really downplayed that. They played it like this was a legitimate, completely legitimate win. No mention about the tights whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Like it almost felt like Jim Ross and Dusty were trying to protect the fact that this was a heel tactic. And my question is, did this match air in Japan, and how did those commentators play up the?
That's
the
a great.
Story?
You know what? That's a great question, Wei. I'm assuming it would have had to, right? Because I know that the press conference after the match in Japan, where Flair ran in and stole the belt, got a lot of attention. Mm. So I'm guessing it must have got back to Japan, and I'm sure they would have sold it that way. As
our guy was screwed.
Absolutely, yeah. Flair was the heel. He screwed Fujinami out of the win. Mm-hmm. And live, you're not hearing the commentary. I had no problem. To me, that's exactly how it should have been. Mm-hmm. Flair was the big heel at that point, and that was Flair's MO is that it was you paid to see. You might be there the one night Flair loses that title. You know what I mean? Like it really worked with him as heel champion, constantly thwarting the baby faces. And I think the other thing for me too is that Fujinami to me was a breath of fresh air. He wasn't a regular North American guy. He wasn't somebody you saw on a regular basis, and just I think to me, just bringing a guy from Japan and I don't know, it just gave it such a big match feeling to me.
And how often would they continue to do that throughout?
Quite a bit. Way the famous one is what was it? Was it one of the later Super Brawls?
I know they did one in Japan.
There's one. Is it 93 or 94? And I can't remember if it's a Super Brawl or a Stamp. It might have been Spring Stampede or one of those where they had. It was all Japanese versus Americans, you know, Otani versus Eddie Guerrero and all that kind of stuff. And everyone worked on that show, like Kojima and Tenzan and Chono was on that show. So I mean, they would do it and they would have shows every once in a while back and forth. But I mean, yeah, it fell apart eventually after a while. But I enjoyed it while it was happening because that was honestly way – that would have been the first place I would have saw Otani, first place I saw Tenzan, Kojima, before I started to really start looking into tapes and trying to find Japanese stuff. That was my first – and Otani, I was just blown away by Otani right away.
Any other notes from your live experience that you'd like to share?
Just a couple other things about what we did. The night before, we got there on Friday, and Friday night we went and saw an indie show, the Sunshine Wrestling Alliance, and it was out back of a shrimp restaurant.
In the back of a shrimp seafood restaurant. Okay.
They had the ring set up, and the only guys of note that people might know is Buddy Landell was on the card. He was kind of their main heel, and Al Perez. And one of my lasting images is of going into the washroom to go to the bathroom, and there's Al Perez taking a piss with the belt on. He was wearing the belt while he took a piss, which I thought was pretty hilarious. We had a great time at that show. I got incredibly drunk. I threw my drink at one of the heel managers. I almost got thrown out of the show, and my buddies found me slumped over the car, passed out at the end of the night.
Those, like rinky-dink shows are just as fun.
They are. We had a great time at that show. Yeah. And then the other thing that you might get a kick out of, the hotel, well, actually it was more of a motel, I guess, that we stayed in, not exactly the nicest place. Giant cockroaches in the room, and we're sleeping in the middle of the night. I think it was Saturday night, and we're just hearing this huge battle and smashing and all this shit going on, and we wake up in the morning and a bunch of crackheads had rented the room beside us, got all whipped up on crack and actually trashed the entire hotel room. Cops were there, hotel people were there, the room I saw inside the room, it was absolutely trashed.
Wow.
So
that sounds perfect.
It was pretty crazy.
That
weekend.
Was your time in St. Petersburg, Russia.
Yeah.
Salvador Dali, crackheads, independent wrestling.
Yeah. Yeah, the Dali Museum was great. I encourage anyone to go because it was started by a guy that started collecting Dali before Dali was even well known. Mm. So the guy literally had tons of stuff, and he donated it to the state of Florida as long as they would build a museum.
Why Florida? What's his association with the
– I don't think anything with Dali. I think it was the guy that was the collector, right?
Okay.
And the thing about it is it's a small museum, and they constantly change it because they have so much stuff. Like it's the biggest collection of Dali stuff in one place.
Cool.
So I liked, like you said earlier, I enjoyed the surrealism of going to see Dali stuff in the afternoon and then going to watch wrestling that night. There you go.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Very much inspired.
There you go.
We go to some of your feedback now. We don't have too much of it, but Flair.
Has anyone even seen this show before?
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people have, at least, three people here, four people who decide to leave feedback. And maybe you and I will go back and forth here as we read. First of all, we got Tom, who says, I was just wondering, why did Mouth see the show live? Well, we answered that.
Yeah, man. Like I said, it was my first chance to see Flair live, and the Fujinami thing just really sold me. Plus, I was very into the Sting and Luger against the Steiners. That was the other big attraction.
He says, I assume Jim Herd was still in charge of WCW at this time, and Kip Fry and Bill Watts were not?
Yeah, I think so, because you've got Flair with the haircut and just some of these gimmicks totally smell of Jim Herd.
The person who attacked the Southern Boys was Badstreet, a.k.a. Brad Armstrong.
Oh, okay.
The matches from the U.S. tag match to the stretcher match were okay to bad. The computer match between Dustin Rhodes and Terrence Taylor was probably the best of the squash matches on the pay-per-view. I'm sure Mouth and I would have rather seen Stan Hansen versus Dustin Rhodes instead.
Which
was mentioned on the Danger Zone. I was disappointed in the Brian Pillman versus Barry Windham match. I was expecting a pretty good match, but it looked like the taped fists seemed to limit what they could do. I'm sure Mouth enjoyed the Missy Hyde segment after the Oz versus Tim Parker match. Can someone please explain to me how you can win a stretcher match via pinfall?
Yeah, exactly. With the claw of all things. Yeah. It's because, you know, that's all he could do. El Gigante could do very little. Like, I mean, like Way said, Sullivan had to help him get another guy on the stretcher.
The TV title match between Anderson and Eaton was really good. I hope Bobby Eaton is doing well. It was really good and told a good and logical story. My only complaint in the match would have been the spot where Bobby gets thrown onto the ramp. Oh, that was actually my favorite spot.
Yeah, I didn't like – I would have rather had a clean finish because, like I said, Arn's run as TV champion really kind of meant something, and it would have been so much better if Eaton had just won clean.
Overall, I give the show a 7 out of 10 for the last three matches on the show.
Wow, that's pretty good, a 7 out of 10.
Yep. Here we go. Up next, this right
this
there.
One?
Yeah.
Hey, guys, I'm really looking forward to this review. This is from –
J.M. Templeton.
Right. I'm really looking forward to this review. I find early WCW to be an interesting period because the Jim Herd era brought it with silly gimmicks, RoboCop, but WCW still probably had the best workers in the country. That's exactly right. They would have silly stuff, but in the main events were always really strong. Even on the TV, the weekly TV, they would have Wyndham versus Flair for the entire hour or something like that. Mm-hmm. They used to do great stuff back then. At least they did before Ric Flair left the company later that year. Right. I really enjoyed last week's review, too. The Jim Crockett Promotions early WCW era is one that I'm learning more about all the time and very much enjoy. I would like to second the suggestion of a previous poster to review the original Starrcade later this year, as it would be the 30th anniversary. That's right, 1983. Good luck getting along with Pollock. I'm sure you'll do great. What's that mean?
Good luck getting along with Pollock. Without Pollock.
Oh, is that what it's... Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah. Okay, without...
Hey, I'm having a very difficult time, but not that difficult. But, I mean, like, we really definitely take for granted how much that guy does.
He does, especially when it comes to the website and the updates and everything.
Oh,
yeah,
God.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's taken, like, five men to just for him. Next up, we got Ronaldo from Milan, Italy, who says...
Wow.
This show brings back memories of me buying wrestling magazines and finding ads of WCW tapes. This was 1991 in WCW. As always, made sure to fuck things up. But Flair versus Fujinami was not only a reminder of the good and old days when the world champ would face challenges from all over the world, the rest of the card is meaningless. I remember that Sting Luger versus Steiner's match got first place as match of the year in the Pro Wrestling Illustrated Year End Awards. Quite an accomplishment back in the day, considering Bret versus Mr. Perfect was also in the same year. Am I a dumb mark for remembering stuff like this? Probably. Glad it's like that.
The other thing, too, is it's funny that we make fun of WCW having the silly gimmicks, but you got to remember at this time, WWF was really, and I mean really, starting to get insane. Mm. And, you know, people think it's PG now and that it's aimed at little kids now. Hey, man, early 90s, especially after that period, oh man, we start to get into our Dukes, the Dumpster Drosies,
yeah,
and the Godwins, and you know, Knuckleball Schwartz, and the Goon, and
Nails.
And just tons and tons of terrible, terrible gimmicks. Yeah. Like, you know, and this, it's just a lot of really bad stuff. And again, to me, I just liked WCW so much better because I would watch the 1 hour syndicated show and I would see better wrestling than I'd see in a whole WWF pay per view at that time. Mm. Here we go. Trent from Texas. The Steiners versus Luger and Sting match was, in my opinion, the greatest match of all time up to that point. Oh, geez. In terms of pure in-ring action. Might be a little bit of an exaggeration. The match blows everything I'd ever seen up to that point away. A young Scott Steiner was truly amazing and one of the greatest specimens in wrestling history. I'll agree.
Yeah.
When he was young, he was still big, but man, oh man, could he work. And he was so good at taking stuff that he saw and learned in Japan and adapting it to the North American style. Like, I'm telling you, first time he did Frankensteiner, I freaked. I thought he was going to drop the guy on his head.
Especially for a guy that size.
That's right. And he did it so easily, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I agree with. Whether that's the best match of all time up to that point, questionable. My favorite part of the entire show happened when One Man Gang and Kevin Sullivan attacked El Gigante. While Gigante was in the middle of slamming Gang on the stretcher, Sullivan completely broke kayfabe and very carefully held the stretcher sturdy so Gigante wouldn't miss it, and then went back into kayfabe and attacked Gigante exactly.
Like on the ramp,
yeah.
In full view
yeah,
of the entire
right.
arena.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Was there a lot of buildup for the Oz gimmick? Were there vignettes of any kind or hype for this? I don't remember there being vignettes. I thought it all started at that pay-per-view.
And how long did Oz last?
Not long. No way. I remember maybe a couple squashes on TV, and I think he was in a couple pay-per-view matches, but like that's it. It was not. I mean, look, they booed it out of the building as soon as he came out. I think this gimmick was inspired by the success of Undertaker, where they wanted a supernatural and gimmick involving a big guy. You know what? I think that's putting too much thought into it. I don't think they're even thinking like that. But as soon as the Tin Man and Cowardly Lion came out, this shit the bed right on scene. Well, you're right. I mean, listen to everybody boo. Overall, I enjoyed the show, and it made me long for Jim Ross 6 out of 10.
Jim Ross was great on the show.
Yeah, he had to do a lot of work because,
yeah.
To me, Dusty is just a bunch of expressions. Dusty's not really good at getting guys over, even though he was the booker and stuff like that. He's not really that good at it.
Overall, was this your second time watching the show? Would it be your third?
It was probably, yeah, because I had someone tape the pay-per-view while I was down there, and I used to have the tape, but I couldn't find
it. Well, 15 but, or whatever, 20-something years later, what did you think of the show, and what do you rate it?
I would probably give it a 7, I think, out of 10. Obviously the main matches were very good, but there was a lot of filler. But, you know, there was a lot of laugh-out-loud moments, too, which are kind of, you know.
They're quick matches, though. Like,
yes.
Really quick matches.
Yeah, again, I think it's the early days of pay-per-view still. I think they're still trying to figure out what to do. It's not like today where they would give some of those bigger matches more time or anything.
Yeah.
And plus, again, I think that WCW saw their pay-per-views, maybe because they weren't seen as readily around the world as WWF, that here's a chance to introduce new guys. Here's a chance to, excuse me, maybe just put in a jobber match, you know, to kill a couple minutes with Big Josh and a couple of bears, you know?
Yeah.
So I think they like to use their pay-per-view for that kind of stuff.
I give the show a 6.5. I thought there are a lot of, like, really fun, ridiculous gimmicks.
Yeah.
Just, I mean, if anything, just watch the entrances. Don't really bother to sit through the matches. But that was fun to kind of go through and discuss. And you know, like we talked about, the tag match was great.
Yeah.
Main event was pretty good, too.
Yep. So. Yeah.
There you go, and that's really it. Anything else to add?
No, not really. I hope anyone wants to check it out. I mean, you can find it all online if you just look around. It's all there. If anything, you should check out the Oz segment.
Oz for sure.
Yeah, I think most people would. If you're a Kevin Nash fan, you don't really know his history and all these crazy gimmicks like the was it the Diamond Stud or was that Scott Hall?
Vinny Vegas,
yeah. Right? Yeah. And the Master Blaster and Oz, they put him through quite a few. Before.
No wonder this guy had such a a chip on his shoulder afterwards.
You're right. In certain perspective, it actually you can understand it because they put a lot of dumb gimmicks on him.
Yeah. You're back on The Law this Sunday.
Yes.
Jay.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. After taking a break for Thanksgiving.
We have your chat with Demolition on the show.
Oh, we're going to play that this week? Yeah, when Wei and I and Jay, we were all at the Hamilton Comic Con couple weeks ago. And Demolition were there with Mickey James, and we've played the Mickey James. So,
How did you enjoy, when we were at the Comic Con, Mouth bought a copy of a comic that I really enjoy. It's called Ecstatics. Ecstatics versus Avengers, actually.
Yeah.
This was the trade that you bought by an artist that I love called Mike Allred.
Yeah,
Have you read it?
No, I haven't had a chance to sit down and read it, but I was a huge fan of X-Force and Ecstatic when he took it on.
Yeah.
A friend of mine gave me the entire run, and I really, really enjoyed it. So when I saw that there, I'd never read this story I don't remember this story with the Avengers. So as soon as I saw it, and I'm with you, the guy used to do a comic called Madman that I thought was really great. He just has a totally unique style, and I think
it's a very comedic style without like really trying
but the thing about that I found so fascinating and that was cool is that when that guy came and stopped Madman and actually went to, because Madman was for one of the smaller companies, it wasn't for DC or Marvel, but I thought it was really cool to see one of the big companies accept this guy and all of a sudden here's a guy with a very different style than what the Marvel style is,
mm-hmm.
And you're really letting him go, run with it. And I love his drawing of the Avengers, and whenever he would draw different Marvel characters and
actually,
stuff like
he's
that.
Doing a Silver Surfer coming up next.
You're kidding?
Yeah.
Like a new?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah,
you know what? I don't know if I've ever told I fucking love the Silver Surfer. It's one of my favorite characters. The original series in the late 60s, early 70s, it only ran for 15 issues because it was too – I really think it was too weird for people.
Right.
But I have them all. I had them all from when I was a kid. I absolutely loved – one of the very first comics I ever remember owning was – one of the later issues where he fought Spider-Man, and it was really cool because they did one of those things where they intertwined real life
with space.
Yeah, and it's like, well, not only that, but in the story with Spider-Man and the Surfer, there's a little kid character who's a huge comic book fan, and his dad's like, "Ah, these comic books are going to rot your mind." And they show the comic books, and they've got Captain America. They're all Marvel characters, right? And the kid ends up being involved in the battle. And I just thought, as a youngster, I thought, wow, this is really cool. They're kind of showing the real world mixing with the fantasy world, you know? I thought it was really cool. And the Surfer, I mean, some of the comics might seem a little heady now. It was the late 60s in that, right? But I thought they were really good, and I thought Stan Lee's writing on a lot of them. Although, did Stan Lee write that now? I'm not sure. But I forget who wrote it, but it was really good barometer of the times. They used Silver Surfer to very much deal with a lot of the issues of the day, the political unrest, the generation gap.
Like using space as a metaphor?
I don't know if it was so much using space as a metaphor. It was more along the lines of the Surfer as someone who doesn't understand Earth and is trying to learn the culture and what motivates. Like, he was constantly going on about, oh, what is it that motivates man, and why do they act this way, and why are they so barbaric towards each other, and why can they not find peace and all that? And that's very much what the 60s and early 70s were like, man. You had a lot of conflict, a lot of questioning of longstanding morals and values, and I thought they really address that stuff well in the Silver Surfer comics. So almost every time they've done it since, I've never found it to be as fun and captivating. They even did a run where they turned it into kind of a humor character, which I hated. I did not like at all. But I did not know that.
Yeah, so that was just announced.
Is he writing it too?
No, he's not. He's just drawing it.
Okay, but still.
Actually, Dan Slott is writing it, the guy who does Superior Spider-Man.
Oh!
Yeah.
Yeah. That, you know what? I would totally be up for that.
Yeah, me too.
That sounds really cool.
Yeah.
The other thing with the Surfer that was neat is that they actually even had an animated series for it. Only ran for 1 year.
What point?
Yeah, I can't remember if it's late 90s or early 2000s.
Well, I know they did a Fantastic Four cartoon.
There was an 80s – well, there was a couple. There was an 80s cartoon that was terrible where they took out the Human Torch and put in Herbie the Robot because they were worried that kids were going to freaking set themselves – seriously, Wei, they were worried that kids were going to set themselves on fire.
Oh,
so they had
God.
Herbie the Robot instead of Torch. It was terrible. I hated it. But there was a FF one in the 90s, and the Silver Surfer one was awesome because it combined – classical animation with digital animation.
Oh, yeah.
And it was really cool. Like, Galactus was done all digitally. And then the rest was done like with conventional animation.
So
visually, it had a great work. I'm not surprised you never heard of it because it didn't do well. And it was one of those shows that was on like Saturday morning, and 1 week it would be on at 10, and then the next week it's on 11:30, that it was never in the same spot. I think it only ran for a year. I don't think it's ever been put out on DVD or anything. Mm-hmm. But it was really good.
That's
it was
cool.
really cool.
You sold me on the Silver Surfer. I never really read much before, but yeah, for sure.
You might get a kick out of reading some of the 60s ones. I mean, they might seem a bit heavy now, maybe, but I think at the time they were pretty like that was one of the big ones with the college kids. Like, it was really like older people were reading Silver Surfer, right? It wasn't like a kiddie book.
To go out. What are we going to go out to?
Oh, what? Oh.
Oh, wait. Before we do that, I should mention what we got next week.
Okay.
Next week on Review Away, we have Jason Agnew.
Yes.
Your better half. Or lesser half.
Whatever.
Whatever you want to say. Jay and I are going to be looking, much like, you know, this is a show that was very much close to you, Mouth.
Yep.
We're going to do a topic that's very close to Jay, and that would be the topic of Andy Kaufman.
Right.
Jay is very involved, of course, in the comedy
world.
Yes,
that's right.
And he actually did a number of throws for us back when we were doing doing Memphis Wrestling on the Fight Network and also on Byte TV. Where you worked with them a lot on those, writing those.
The Memphis things. Ones. I wrote all the ones on St. Louis.
Okay,
yeah,
right,
I did all the St. Louis shows.
Right.
Yeah,
but Jay and I will be looking at the pro wrestling career of Andy Kaufman in the documentary Andy Kaufman, I'm from Hollywood.
Right.
Which have you seen it?
I have indeed. I think I have it at home.
I haven't seen it. So a listener actually sent that to us recently. So I'm going to watch that.
It's not very long, as I remember.
I believe it's only like an hour.
Yeah.
Or
you
so.
Know what would be nice as a like little kind of side bite, and short. It's short. It's only about half an hour. Do My Breakfast with Blassie.
That's
too.
Actually on the same DVD.
Oh.
Yeah.
You should do both.
Yeah, we might do
you
that.
You really should, because honestly, Wei, the Blassie one, it is one of the strangest pieces of entertainment I've ever
seen explain.
In my life. Well, it's Blassie. It's just Blassie and Andy Kaufman sitting in a restaurant. But the things that they talk about are like, I'm not telling
right,
you nothing because I don't want to ruin, because I want you to watch it. And I want you and Jay to do that one too.
It's just the two of them having breakfast and talking.
My Breakfast with Blassie. There was a big film at the time called My Dinner with Andre. So it's a parody on the title of that. And it was done very short. And Kaufman was a huge Blassie fan. Blassie was just up for anything at that point. He was very much doing other stuff outside of wrestling. He had done his records and all that kind of stuff. And seriously,
all right, for sure, we'll do that.
I think you should do both. I really do. I think you'll have a ball.
That'll be what Jay and I are doing next week. And Thursday we got Review and Impact with Nate Milton, and then Agnew and Bauer, or is it Bauer and Agnew?
I think it's they're doing the show together. Yeah.
So all of your shows are going to be here, despite the fact that John Pollock is nowhere to be found right now.
He's at the Russian McDonald's trying to get a coffee.
Right. Yes. So follow him on Twitter, on Instagram at Law Radio. Mouth, what about your Twitter?
What Twitter?
When are you going to get on Twitter and Instagram and all that stuff?
Well, I could see maybe Instagram. I find that a bit more fun than Twitter. But
you do need a cell phone, though, Mouth.
Yeah, I know, exactly.
Which you do not have. You're only person I know in existence.
Really?
Who does not have a cell phone.
Oh, I have a...
Even my parents have cell phones.
Oh, I know a few people here and there that don't, but I realize I'm in the minority. The thing about Twitter, I think... It kind of put me off after that guy did the fake.
Oh, there's a fake Mouth account.
Yeah, this guy started it up and he started maligning wrestlers. And I had to actually go to Twitter. I had to send Twitter evidence of who I was. I had to give them.
So you actually have a verified account on Twitter?
Well, I don't now.
Oh, you
no,
deleted
no.
It.
Oh, yeah. As soon as I had to, this guy was maligning wrestlers and saying it was me. Right? I thought this is going to kill the show if I don't deal with this. So I had to send them ID and all this stuff and prove that I was real Dan Lavransky.
All the more reason to take over that account and praise wrestling.
I don't know, Wei. I don't see it happening.
Well, you
yet.
Can connect with Mouth on Facebook.
Yes, I am. I am on Facebook quite a bit.
At Dan the Mouth Lavransky or Dan Lavransky.
Yep. Yeah.
And subscribe to us on iTunes, which you probably are. I'm trying to do this close. It's very unnatural. So why don't you pick a song for us to go out with?
Ah, jeez, I'm trying to.
How did you like my?
Well, if you can find it, we should play some old WCW one. From like around this time. I don't know if you can find Bad Street USA by the Freebirds.
Of course we could.
The one I always used to love, even though he wasn't on this show, is Cactus Jack's old WCW
theme.
You
got to pick one. Can't have a whole set.
Okay, I'm just trying to look at the note. I would say, just because for this one, I would go out with the Bad Street USA, just because the Freebirds.
Done.
It's a great song.
Let me pull that out of my archive, put that on the vinyl.
Drop it on the turntable. Yes. Yeah, there we go.
Is.
Crackle.
Great. Excellent.
I work for the Army for the United States Marines. Cause he know how to handle his pants to be seen.
That's free in Atlanta, yeah. That's free in the whole USA. That's free in Atlanta.
The further down I block you with the banner you got. That they were nasty, couldn't make it out of my block. But I'll never forget it, hearing that evidence died on Savior. Someone should have told me those boys are made in USA. So don't you come looking on the side there. Cause this is where the fever's here, but everything's going down. If you don't know by now, we always get our way back. That's the way it is down here on Bastion USA.
Bastion in Atlanta.